Hello,
Okay,
friends.
Francis.
Okay. Welcome to this seventh webinar in the Light of the Soul. We started it on the first Sunday of January, and here we are in the seventh month in July. This really unique book. It's all about articulating the steps that we must take to become soul infused, and it does it in a meticulous entirety. The preferred second ray method. So we started our last session by taking a look at the seventh sutra of book one, which states the basis of correct knowledge is correct perception, correct deduction, and correct witness or accurate evidence. This sutra is a summation of the three ways by which we gain knowledge. Correct has a whole different meaning when you're looking at these sutras. It has to do with, you could substitute the word correct for soul-aligned, soul-aligned knowledge, soul-aligned perception, etc. So, this, as I said, this sutra is a summation of the three ways by which we gain knowledge. First, perception, direct cognition, mediated by the five senses. Correct perception requires a still, non-reactive astral body to act as an undistorted sounding board for the incoming sensory frequencies. If the astral is turbulent, then the direct cognition is thrown out. There's no there's a distorted connection between the brain and the mind. Second, deduction, the reasoning powers of the lower mind. Correct deduction, remember, correct meaning soul aligned. Requires a mental vehicle operating free of any personal bias, utilizing logic to discern and apply those universal laws governing the lower quaternary. Correct witness, is the direct intuitive cognitions at a much higher level now, direct intuitive cognition of the soul. Or one who is soul aligned, centered in its own consciousness and perceiving reality from the causal plane, stripped of all lower vehicle mediation. We then learned that, quote, in the West, the idea has mostly been held that the mind is that part of the human mechanism which utilizes knowledge, the process of turning things over in the mind. Of striving to solve problems by hard mental labor has no part, ultimately, in the unfoldment of the soul. It is only a preliminary stage and has to be superseded by a different method. So the lower mind can only understand a problem, a theory, or a system by breaking it into pieces. And looking at how those parts interrelate. The occult method is not so much to turn off the intellect, but to shift its polarity. The yogi stops analyzing and instead holds the mind steady in the light of the soul. Like a parabolic antenna, the intellect must remain sharply focused and structurally rigid, but its function changes from transmitter of logic to a receptive vessel for direct intuitive realization. So it's really about moving from being a outgoing source of intellect to a receptive receiver of soul. Light, which is higher mind. So why the shift from the unrefined mental process to the disciplined intellect? Because the average chaotic mind is constantly generating reactive thought forms. And in so doing, it creates a static field that blocks out soul impressions. The intellect, when disciplined and positively polarized, serves as an organ of perception designed to register the vibrations of the higher mental plane. We then took a look at five steps for working with the mind, which include control and stabilization, resulting in correct knowledge, right use of the perceiving faculty, right interpretation of that which is perceived, and right transmission to the physical brain, resulting in correct reaction of the physical brain to the transmitted knowledge. All of this comes down to stilling the lower activities generated by the personality in order to become receptive to the soul. To avoid mistaking an astral impression for the light of the soul, which is a real problem in the beginning, a twofold fail-safe process is used that requires both the assent of the intuition and of the reason. Assent of the intuition, which operates through the second aspect, means adherence to the intent and vibratory quality of the original transmission. I'll say that again. The assent of the intuition translates into adherence to the original intent and the vibratory quality of the original transmission. For example, the initiate receiving transmission might, in order to test it through the intuition, might ask, does my translation carry the original energetic signature? Is it universally applicable? Does it inspire? The originating verifying impulse is Buddhic, but the actual assent, the registration, coordination, and verification of the translation happens on the higher mental plane. The assent of reason is a function of the mind-brain connection, and thus has to do with the rigorous logic of the translation. For example, does the impression make practical structural sense without losing the informing potency? It comes down to, is it logically sound? The reward for this work is that, quote, the disciple on the physical plane becomes increasingly aware of the things of the soul and the mysteries of the soul realm. We then took a look at an old commentary. Excuse me a minute. That warns against the dangers for those who are just beginning this work, and which can be summed up with the statement, the clear-cut outlines cannot be perceived, and wraiths and shadows, gloomy spaces and areas full of darkness as yet confuse his vision. DK then states, at the close of this sentence is found a curious symbol which conveys to the disciple's mind the thought of, quote, keep silent and reserve your opinion. Silence, because silence keeps the erroneous thought forms ungrounded, thus aiding their dissipation, right? As soon as you speak, you enforce whatever it is you're saying. And if you're still in this this place of unsureness, you know, of wraiths and shadows, then it's best not to ground any of those perceptions, right? reserving one's opinion is an act of humility, and neutrality, especially neutrality, it's very much like silence. I would say even going further and say not forming an opinion, right? Just holding the balanced, neutral place. This helps to keep the mental lens fluid and open, and further prevents kama manas from taking hold. You know, this is why over the doors of the Pythagorean ashram, there was the statement, know thyself, and then, which is the process that we are undergoing through the study of this book. And then when you walk through the door, the first thing you're hit with is silence for, you know, depending on the source you read, from 1 to 3 years, you say nothing. And here we understand why, because it keeps one from falling into the kama manasic illusion. We then moved on to the Eighth Sutra, which states, eight, incorrect knowledge is based upon perception of the form and not upon the state of being. An in-depth look at the meaning of the two key words in this sutra make clear its meaning. Forms are built out of elemental, physical, astral, or lower mental matter. They are always temporary, heavily conditioned by time and space, and begin to decay from the very moment they are created. A state of being is an energetic matrix, a specific vibratory signature that temporarily conditions that form. To achieve correct knowledge, the stabilized mind must act as a clear organ of vision. It must deliberately pierce through the physical appearance, the turbulence of the astral fog, and the crystallized thought forms of the lower mind. By bypassing the superficial form, the observer registers the underlying state of being, the persistent animating vibration that the entity is radiating into the world. We then learned that, quote, Raja Yoga trains a man to function in his second aspect, and through that second aspect to put himself en rapport with the true nature latent in any form. So the first part of this focuses on learning to function in one's soul aspect. Traditional psychology works to optimize the personality, but for those on the path of return, being en rapport is not a psychological state, but rather the achievement of soul contact, which acts as an energetic bridge, enabling the personality to reflect the light of the ego. Through this light, the observer transcends the physical and astral appearances, perceiving the underlying divine geometry, the soul essence that animates every form. Bailey then basically restates the sutra in different words, quote, all knowledge, therefore, which is acquired through the medium of the lower faculties and which is based upon the form aspect, is incorrect knowledge. So, knowledge gained by means of the lower mental, astral, and physical sheaths, no matter how astute, is inherently erroneous, because these vehicles are limited to perceiving effects, the effects of life, rather than its causes. When we rely solely on the lower faculties, we mistake the temporary decaying form aspect, even thought form aspect, for the enduring reality. The final quote, from last time states, the soul alone perceives correctly. The soul alone has the power to contact the germ or the principle of Bodhi, in the Christian phraseology, the Christ principle, to be found at the heart of every atom, whether it is the atom of matter as studied in the laboratory of the scientists, whether it is the human atom in the crucible of daily experience, whether it is the planetary atom within those whose ring pass not all our kingdoms of nature are found, or the solar atom, God in manifestation through the medium of a solar system. So last time we did a deep dive exploring what it actually takes for the soul to engage at each of these levels. There's some surprising results. But the most relevant orientation of the soul in terms of contacting the germ or principle is indicated by this last statement. Christ knew what was in man and therefore could be a savior. So if you looked at that in relation to what we just read, Christ knew because he personified the second aspect of divinity. Operating through the consciousness of the Buddhic plane, he could instantly bypass the dense shell of the human personality and achieve sympathetic resonance with the hidden spark in every person. By tuning into the resonant frequency of a person's soul, he knew the state of being radiating from within and could apply the magnetic stimulation needed to help expand that soul influence over that personality. And that pretty much takes us up to where we left off last time. I want to encourage you to ask questions and make comments, you know, anytime in today's webinar. The only thing I ask is that you keep your questions and comments relevant to the material that we're actually discussing. Okay. Alrighty then. Let's see, what's this chat? Yeah, okay. Okay, so we start this month with sutra number 9. If we could get a reader, please.
I'll start us off today.
Terrific.
Fancy rests upon images which have no real existence. This means that these images have no real existence insofar as they are conjured up by men themselves, constructed within their own mental auras, energized by their will or desire, and are consequently dissipated when attention is directed elsewhere. Energy follows thought is a basic tenet of the Raja Yoga system. And is true, even where these images of fancy are concerned. These fancied images fall primarily into three groups, which the student would do well to consider. First, those thought forms which he constructs himself, which have an evanescent life and which are dependent upon the quality of his desires, being therefore neither good nor evil, low nor high, can be visualized by low tendencies or idealistic aspirations, with all the intermediate stages to be found between these extremes. The aspirant has to guard himself in order that he may not mistake these for reality.
Thank you, BL. Okay, so first the sutra itself. Funny word, fancy. You know, I think this was used a lot more in the days when this book was compiled than it is today. But as we go along, we'll see into the meaning of this word. Okay, so fancy rests upon images which have no real existence. Fancy is called vikalpa in Sanskrit, and it's defined as the creative act of combining fragments of memory into temporary forms that lack any real objective reality. These mental constructs are generated by the personality's fears, desires, and aspirations because they are drawn entirely from the debris of past experience. They have no structural anchor on the higher planes. They are essentially psychological hallucinations that obscure the truth of the present moment. Next. This means that these images have no real existence insofar as they are conjured up by men themselves, constructed within their own mental auras, energized by their will or desire, and are consequently dissipated when attention is directed elsewhere. So desire excites the field of astral matter, and the lower will provides the structural boundaries of the kamamanasic construction. Everybody knows what kamamanasic is, right? That's desire mind, that combination of a little bit of mind and a lot of desire that creates thought forms, most thought forms, that is. Because these images originate within the personal aura, they create a closed circuit. The creator feeds the thought form with attention, and the thought form reflects that same vibration back into the creator's brain. This circular feed sustains the illusion of reality. Next, energy follows thought is a basic tenet of the Raja Yoga system. And it's true even where these images of fancy are concerned. These fancied images fall primarily into three groups, which a student would do well to consider. So the nature of the energy that follows thought is the neutral, unconditioned essence of the mental and astral planes. 1 minute. Which is that didn't help at all. Which is directed into these forms regardless of their objective reality. So, what he's saying here is that the energy is neutral itself, the energy that animates the thought. The mind creates the mold, the elemental essence blindly rushes in to vitalize it. If the thought is a fiction, the resulting thought form becomes a parasitic elemental, which it invariably is if it conforms to this particular sutra called, which deals with fancy. Okay, so let's take a look at the three groups of fancied images. First, those thought forms which he constructs himself, which have an evanescent life and which are dependent upon the quality of his desires, being therefore neither good nor evil, low nor high, can be vitalized by low tendencies or idealistic aspirations, with all the intermediate stages to be found between these extremes. The aspirant has to guard himself in order that he may not mistake these for reality. So, as the structural mental material, citta, mind stuff, possesses no inherent morality. So the mind begins by simply constructing a neutral geometric boundary with good or evil qualities only projected into this neutral form, thought form, by the creator after it has been built. These forms possess evanescent life because they lack the permanent anchor of an egoic or triadal archetype. They are held together by a weak, fluctuating magnetic cohesion that requires a constant supply of kama, or desire, to maintain their structural integrity. These thought forms function as temporary elemental batteries, entirely dependent upon the creator's sustained attention for its charge. As soon as the attention is removed, the thought forms fall apart. The transition between low tendencies and idealistic aspirations is characterized by the subplane on which the astral fuel, from which the astral fuel is drawn. A low tendency uses matter from lower astral subplanes. An idealistic aspiration uses refined matter from the higher astral subplanes. Structurally, both remain astral constructs, and thus both are still fall under the concept of being fancy, right? And thus both remain a kind of localized fiction. The final warning addresses the nature of glamour. The aspirant constructs a form within his or her immediate aura, which reflects the aspirant's projected vibration. The aspirant then perceives this reflection and misidentifies it as an external revelation, because the initial projection can often be unconscious. So then you project it and then perceive it and see it as a revelation. Thus it becomes a closed feedback loop, as mentioned before. The required guard is the application of mental objectivity, rigorous mental objectivity, which severs the vitalizing flow of attention, astral usually, thereby dissipating the kama manasic fancy, right? Hard work, and it takes a complete reorientation to the way we interface our thoughts and feelings. Remember the bumper sticker, don't believe everything you think, right? This is the occult physics of that statement, you could say. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Yes. Ariane, can you read that for us, please?
Yes.
Okay, you started talking and then you muted yourself again, or somebody muted you.
Well, I don't believe I did, but maybe it happened. Let's see. Can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
I'm sorry if I did do it. An illustration might well be given here in respect to the facility with which people judge they have seen one of the brothers or masters of the wisdom, whereas all they have perceived is a thought form of one of them. The wish being father to the thought, they are the victim of that form of incorrect perception called by Patanjali fancy. Two, those thought forms which are created by the race, the nation, the group, or the organization. Group thought forms of any kind, from the planetary form to that constructed by any band of thinkers, form the sum total of the great illusion. Here lies a hint to the earnest aspirant. Three, that thought form created by a man since his first appearance in physical form and called the quote-unquote dweller on the threshold, being created by the lower personal self and not by the soul, It is impermanent and is simply held together by the man's lower energy.
Thank you, Ariane. Okay, so let's take a closer look. First, an illustration might well be given here in respect to the facility with which people judge they have seen one of the brothers or masters of the wisdom, whereas all they have perceived is a thought form of one of them. The wish being father to the thought, they are the victim of that form of incorrect perception called by Patanjali fancy. Yeah, I think DK, at some point, one of his letters, he mentions that there's an astral construct of himself, you know, of DK, and that aspiring, you know, people who aspire towards him and are on the ray of devotion and want to forge a connection with him, run into that astral kama monastic form. So when the student reads about or aspires towards a specific master of wisdom, the lower concrete mind begins to isolate mental matter to construct a geometric replica of that master within the student's own mental aura. This form is built entirely from borrowed material, written descriptions, painted portraits, and the collective conceptualizations of other students, you know, and communicated by them. Structurally, the form they are creating is an empty shell. It possesses no inherent consciousness and holds no energetic connection to the actual adept it represents. The text then states the wish being father to the thought. A wish is a concentrated projection of astral desire, comma. The student's longing for guidance, for spiritual validation, or devotional attachment stimulates astral energy, which floods the empty mental shell. The thought form is now vitalized by the student's own astral energy and has thus become an active elemental operating within his or her immediate aura. The reason the student is so easily victimized by this fancy is due to magnetic resonance, because the thought form is constructed entirely from the student's own mental and astral substance. It vibrates in perfect harmonic resonance with the student's own sensory apparatus. Therefore, when the student directs his or her attention towards it, the form simply reflects the student's own injected devotion and anticipated answers back to the physical brain. It feels real because the student is registering the energy of their own concentrated astral activity. The proof of the illusion lies in the quality of the vibration, whereas a fancied image operates completely on the astral and lower mental levels. A true, actual master of the wisdom is polarized in the spiritual triad. Therefore, genuine contact with such a one could only occur via the Antikarana, projecting a true image directly into the higher mind, and is thus completely independent of the sensations or fancy generated by kama manas. So a bit of a harsh teaching. I think the Christ and Jesus probably are mightily burdened by the literally millions upon millions of kama manasic creations of them, you know, that are reflections of themselves on lower planes. Yes, Tia.
I think another way to look at this is that The way to reach the masters is through the soul and the intuition. So any other means of connection has to be a thought form of some kind, because you don't have the physical equipment to reach them. It's only the soul that can do that, and it's a relationship to the ashram and to them on the higher planes where it exists. And that connection being registered in the physical brain that has evolved to a point where it can make that registration.
Yeah, that's well said. Exactly right. We have to develop, first of all, the discrimination of recognizing our own fancy, which are in full bloom, which were, you could say, already plagued with or, immersed in, recognizing them for what they are, and then, through the methods that are being described in this text start to decentralize our orientation to these fancies. And as soon as we do that, they fold, like a paper tent. They don't have any self-generated energy. It's a closed loop with our own projection. Right. So as soon as we get it that, these are our own creations, and we stop providing that animating energy, they're gone. Right. So then the next stage, there's the kind of dark night of the soul in this, because there's so much familiarity for all of us with the fancies we've created, but the next stage is then, I can't help but think of the movie Matrix, where everybody is living this alternative reality. It's like one giant sustained fancy, and only the very, very few who have been willing to quote unquote pull the plug on that can then begin the arduous task of connecting with actual reality. Okay, continuing with the types of fanciful thought.
Francis,
Yeah.
sorry, Ben has a comment. He says, fancy is indeed less than a present palpable reality, but it is greater than remembrance. And that's from John Keats. And she tries to fancy what the flame of a candle looks like after the candle is blown out. And that's from Lewis Carroll.
Interesting. He's, bringing forth two uses of the word fancy here, which are interesting. Thank you, Ben. Okay, so we'll continue with the types of thought forms, types of fanciful thought forms, that is. Second, those thought forms which are created by the race, the nation, the group or the organization, group thought forms of any kind, from the planetary form to that constructed by any band of thinkers, form the sum total of the great illusion. Herein lies a hint to the earnest aspirant. Go ahead, Tia.
Since this is in the section under the problem of union, it seems to me that fancy and these things are all that are self-referencing to the personality. And that is what is the obstacle to the soul infusion, because the soul, its whole purpose is service and sacrifice. It has no interest in anything that is self-referencing, it is impersonal. And so if we are engaged in anything that seems to elevate the personality, then we're probably in fancy.
Right, there it is, red flag number one. If you're involved in self-reference, you are, deep in fancy, no question. There would be no way that any self-referencing comment or thought form would be other than fancy. Barbara.
Yes, well, it is perhaps that Madame Blavatsky is suggesting that there is a tradition of truth, that there are wisdom traditions, and that the wisdom traditions may have something of local thought forms, but they also have a truth that is important for evolution and for service, that much of higher manas is in symbols. It's in geometry. It's in sound. And to be of service to humanity for evolution, that needs to move through the Ansakarana and connect with some of these traditions of truth. And as I understand, Madame Blavatsky said that it's not useful for evolution of humanity to live alone in caves with
right.
with certain impressions that don't have the heart of service.
Yeah, well said. It's true that, you know, the same ageless wisdom teachings can impact us in really different ways as we ourselves progress, as our consciousness evolves. We can look at, you know, what we read 30 years ago, let alone 20 lifetimes ago in some other form, and see it in an entirely different light, because it will speak to us in accordance with where we are in the present, you know, where we are on the path. You know, I've read some of DK's books more than once, and I'm always astonished on the reread to discover that meanings that I absolutely didn't catch at all the first time through, or I had a complete different conception of, right? But they can be ways of pulling ourselves up out of personality reference and personality understanding. You know, if we, you could say, dedicate ourselves to the real truth in the words of the ageless wisdom, you know, whatever form that they might take. So, anyone else? Okay, so this particular group of fanciful thought forms, you know, it's all about being conditioned by groups or organizations, nations, and even humanity as a whole, you know, shares certain of these types of fanciful thought forms, right? Yes, Carol.
Okay, this is a fairly big subject to me because I'm somewhat clairvoyant, not super, but so the big problem is if you're seeing clairvoyance, first of all, chakras, that's fine. But if you're getting images, you're spending a lot of time trying to figure out or ignoring it. It's like a dream, you know, like, should I pay attention to this or not? Did I make it? Did I actually have had somebody sending me once intentionally, which they shouldn't do. And I know how to do it, but I don't do it to other people, except for we were shown how to do it for healing. So I can do it for that. But I don't like, somebody was trying to get me to really respect a particular organization. I'll say it that way because it's nice and broad. And so they were sending me certain things, but they didn't realize that this is already something I'm aware of. So I wasn't taking it seriously. I knew. And we were also warned in Pranic Healing Books that if you go to a psychic for a reading, who knows whose thought forms they're reading, because they're sticky. They can be all over the place. It's like germs. You know, you could have they could have picked you could have picked up stuff, they could have picked up stuff. That's why we clean our aura all the time. Like I'm going for an ocean swim later because our auras are sticky and they pick up stuff from everywhere. So, and then there's our people probably who are making massive thought forms that are really anti, because we know there's negative masters. That's probably the main thing they do is just send out negative thought forms. So just really, if you see something, really consider it seriously, whether it's a big deal or not. A lot of mine are like diet, so I don't worry about those. I go, oh yeah, eggs are good too, so I'll eat them. But we have to realize that they're not all ours, and not to take, because people get caught up in thinking, oh, that's, I don't know, whoever it is, some master, whatever, and it might not even be your thought, or it was sent to you. That's all I'm trying to say. It could be a warning. But I have a question about Dweller in the Threshold, and I'll ask when we get to that one.
Well, I would just say, based on what you just said, that it just underscores the importance of discrimination. You know, this rigorous mental, what Bailey here calls logical assent, you know, meaning the, you know, learning to use the mind as a neutral tool to assess the nature of what you're being subject to. And then to that, I'd also add the sensitizing yourself to the vibratory quality, irrespective of the content, because, you know, you might have an experience that is very positive, you know, like a vision of the Christ. But you have to be able to also assess the quality of the vibration of what it is that you're visualizing, you know. And it's not that hard. Usually the vibration is very apparent on these things, but you do have to turn your attention to it and make an assessment, right? If you do, then it's usually apparent. And then the other part of it, which is assessing its the subject matter, you know, is a rigorous logical process, right? So that's the feeling and the mental nature of it. Okay, we have Tia.
I would say the only thing I would add was that, I think as Master DK suggested, to keep a spiritual journal, that always is very helpful when we are filtering through some of these psychic forms and what actually is real spiritual impress, telepathy at first, and then intuition as it opens up. And I think as far as seeing on the various planes, that is an evolving process as you work with your intuition. And as you do and you apply more and more of the fifth ray, these things will naturally fall away. And you learn how to deconstruct some of these thought forms. We don't have to accept all of them. If we know that they're untrue or they're temporary, that's one of the services to humanity that we do is that we help dissipate these thought forms.
That's right. Yeah. And as we come to the Aquarian age, that's a big task that, you know, we all have to help in taking on. You know, Aquarius is a fifth ray portal, you know, so the clarity, the mental clarity needed to clear the incredible karma manas that has been built up over the last 2,000 years, you know, it's an awesome task. And everybody has to be become a part of that process. And it the way we do it is using the qualities that we're learning in this light of the soul, you know, these qualities of decentralization, so that your discrimination is accurate, you know, and then calling out the fancies, as it were, and dissipating them with your own energy. Yeah, that's its own subject. let's see, this is Irene, is that right?
Yes, thank you. I have question that I have here. I would like to ask in relation to this material. The thesis here, this is energy follows thought. I've been struggling with this statement, and I know this from masters, it's fundamental, but I would like to ask a question. Is the thought also an energy as well? That means if that yes, then energy follows energy, and the thought is polarized, most likely, unless it come from the master. Unless I'm wrong, just I'm really having here, I'm stuck here. If you
Okay.
can comment on that, thank you.
Yeah, sure. Well, thought forms are forms, and they're created with the citta or mind stuff. That's the container, and then they're infused with particular energies, often that's kama manasic, especially the ones that we're talking about here in terms of fancy. Kama manasic meaning both. The desire or the particular orientation of the thought form in terms of its quality. Does it exist as an aspiration, or is it some form of lower desire? And that, you could say, brings the shell of the thought form, animates it or brings it to life. So that's how energy, which is the kama manasic infusion of the form, which is the thought form itself. That's why energy follows thought. The structure is built first, and then it's animated by the energy that we project into that form.
But where you get the energy? I mean, this is the master's like manual, literally, will reading, and energy follows thought. Is there any description of this energy, or I don't know how to get to
Yeah.
the beginning, like the point zero energy, and
Right.
then follows thought. Can you?
Well, each plane has a certain electrical nature. So astral energy, it's not inherently a form, right? It's the nature of the energy of the astral plane, which you can contact through your solar plexus. I think if you think of a solar plexus experience, either a positive or negative astral or emotional experience, that and you can separate the energy from the form in the sense that you can experience the energy in the abstract, right? Like you could think, this is the kind of energy that animates certain positive thought forms without actually having a thought form present when you do this. It's the kind of a meditation, right? A little more subtle on the mental plane, but the elements help with this, that the element for the astral is water, so it's a very fluid energy. In terms of the nature of your experience of the energy when you're contemplating it, whereas the nature of the mental energy is fiery, and if you can, you have to be able to isolate the energy without contact the energy by means of a thought form. So it's best to use the chakra involved. So, for instance, oops, somebody needs to.
Company, the fastest in
Oh,
that first
I'm
time
sorry.
check.
Hang on just a
No
second.
points on offer, but he goes into green. So I did not expect Agandrinov now to be in any jersey, especially not the green
That's
jersey.
you.
Yeah, it's me. I just had to isolate it. Spontaneous eruption of the Tour de France. It must have picked up on a subconscious thought I was having. Sorry about that. Okay, we'll get back in here. So we're talking about the ability to isolate and have an experience of the energy without housing it in a thought form. And it is possible. And I think the best way to do it is through the two chakras that we tend to have easy access to, the solar plexus for astral energy, and the throat for mental energy. So for instance, you can just focus in the throat and animate it and have an experience of the energy that animates thought forms without actually building a thought form. Tricky, right? But because it's so easy to build a thought form. And the same thing, I think actually easier with the solar plexus and the and astral energy.
Right. And this whole work, the Light of the Soul, is obviously dedicated to the thoughts that are equal to the soul emanation. So how does that energy follows the soul emanation? Any little insight?
Yeah, well, you know, the soul is on the third and second subplane of the mental plane, and it has its own very specific vibratory quality compared to the lower mental. You know, if you've ever had an experience, a spiritual experience, and it was really clear to you that you were having an experience, spiritual experience, that energy, now separated from the content, the energy itself would be from that region, you know. And it's very definite and specifically other than lower mental or astral energy. So,
okay, you're saying that this is recognizable, correct?
Oh, it's very recognizable. You know, if you still yourself in meditation and you have a quote unquote good meditation, it's that good meditation is not based on the thought forms that you are having. You know, you're not, you know, at least if you're meditating, really actually meditating, it's not about, you know, considering thought forms. It's about stilling the mind and orienting yourself to the soul and then coming into a state of receptivity. And in that state, you start to have an experience of the energy of this third and second subplanes of the mental plane. That's just one way of describing it, you know.
Thank you.
It seems, I think, harder than it is, you know. But if you reverse engineer it, if you do this work for a while, you can almost immediately assess the energy of a thought form, the vibrational energy of a thought form, and determine its origins in that way. It's not error free, you know, until you're truly soul infused, because if you're working from a personality base, you're not an adept at this. But it's a doable thing. You know, it's something that we really can choose to make a part of our lives, you know, because it's not just like you're going to say, oh, gee, what thought form should I, you know, determine the energy of now? You know, it's right there in your daily life, you know. So, anybody else?
Thank you, Francis.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Okay, so we're talking, again, I'll say, we're talking about the subforms that are created by the race, nation, groups, or organization. This is a super important point. So we'll take a minute to explore this. Unlike the group one forms built by a single person, group two forms.
Francis?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was talking and someone had muted me. Okay, Tia. Tia's got her hand up. Ariane has her hand up. So,
okay,
Tia, you want to go ahead?
All right. Just in general, wait until I finish talking before you tell me somebody's hand up. I just, it flusters me. But go ahead. You know, because I was right in the middle of this. Now it's gone. So, yeah. So who first, Tia?
I was just going to say, probably the easiest way to do this is, you know, we're taught that we should always adopt the attitude of the observer. It's very hard to gauge the quality of a thought form when you are in it, in the thought form.
Yeah.
But if you make a conscious effort that you're now going to observe your thoughts, you know, you can start out that way. That's probably the easiest way to do it.
It's also the only way.
Yeah.
You have to have set up an observer. It's essential first step for all this work. It's funny that it's not mentioned. You know, she doesn't directly address it. But you absolutely must have this part of yourself that can observe the other part of yourself. If you're immersed just in personality, there's, you know, you probably wouldn't even be here in this webinar if you hadn't already, to some extent, set up the observer. But it can always be strengthened. It's that part of the self that is already decentralized, right?
Well, the thing is, I mean, you set up yourself as the observer to start out with, but you have to know that what we're talking about, you're not going to be really constructing thought forms that we talk about in white magic until after you've taken the third initiation. That's really soul created thought forms. Up until then, you're always going to have some level of distortion because they're personality thought forms. So we can aspire for higher ones always, but we know that there's limitations to it. And, you know, you just emotionally detach from your thought forms and just observe them that way. That's probably the easiest way to do it.
Yeah, the emotional detachment is that's usually the component that gets in our way the most. So, you know, that's a good place to start for sure. You know, Ariane? Let's see, I see a bunch of hands. Who's next, BL?
Actually, can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can.
Tia answered part of it, but say this is related to glamour that many, many people altogether have these thought forms, like are conditioned or en masse have certain kinds of thoughts. I'm wondering about deconstructing them. Besides detaching, like if we've become really identified with something, we're just not in control of our emotional body and we've created something over the years, how do we deconstruct a thought form because it's an energetic entity, or does it just die of its own making by having ceased to have energy feeding it?
It's all about attention. All these fancies supply of vitality is based on our attention and our belief. That's part of the attention, right? Our belief in these. When that's withdrawn, they fold. Unlike, for instance, a thought form originating in the soul, you know, the great truths of being, right? And so it's just coming to the place that you can withdraw your attention and withdraw your belief in those thought forms as being true or real. That is the difficulty. Once you do that, you're able to pretty quickly move past the thought form. I mean, you know, if you've ever seen a kid cry because, you know, like for instance, their sibling took a toy away or something, and we're so totally in ourselves beyond that level of disruption. That perspective is what you're trying to gain, you know, the perspective of an adult to that child who's having this difficulty. you know. That's the perspective we want to gain with our own kama manasic thought forms, right? Which is that the other, you know, the observer, that Tia pointed out, that becomes the adult in this adult-child relationship. And you take on the perspective of the observer that is not attached, as the personality is, you know, and in that way you act as if, you know. I'm always drawn for some reason to this story, you know, where Ram Dass says, you know, I still have this desire to own a Jaguar, meaning the English car. I can find it in my psyche. It just no longer has any energy at all. That's all, you know, but it's sitting there. I can look at it, but it just no longer has any influence over my actions, you know, or my feelings. So I thought that's always struck me, you know, because it's so relatable. You know, we all have some form of that, right, in ourselves. But the whole thing is to withdraw that kama, that desire aspect, from the equation, so that it just simply becomes an empty form that we can easily move on from, you know. Irene.
That's a quick question. Is the observer that have been discussed here is considered a soul in this context, or it is something else? Thank you.
It's your best proxy for the soul for the time being, you know. It's this conscious part of the self that is able to interface the less conscious part of yourself, right? So, you know, for instance, say you get really mad. The observer, if it's in place, will go, you're getting really mad. You know, just that. And then you align with the observer, and the anger starts to drain away, you know, because you're aligning with that part of yourself that's not actually really mad. You're not suppressing it. You know, you're not like gritting your teeth, you know, and saying, I'm not angry. You're identifying with the observer, that part of yourself that is not involved in this intense astral disruption, right? And it'll break the hypnosis, you know, right away. You can even do it, and, you know, Michael Robbins talked to me once about this, and that what he had developed is the ability to feel the pressure of something like anger coming on and catch it before it even hit his psyche, right? So he didn't actually have to involve himself in the experience of the negative emotion, right? Because the trigger, he had so sensitized himself that the trigger happened well before the actual flooding in of that astral energy, the liquid energy of turbulence, right? And I, you know, that's when I realized, you know, that Michael not only was a great teacher, but he really was walking the path, you know, was well on his way in that way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a couple of comments too.
Mm-hmm.
Ben says, ineffabilists, much of the near-death experience narrative and meditation content is clothed in fancy culture, religion, short of direct, ineffable experience.
Wow, yeah. It's so true. Yeah, because it's, It especially relates to what we're talking about right now, which is, this second group of, those thought forms that affect, whole races or groups of people, based on how we've been conditioned, we see these near-death experiences and from a certain perspective. And that creates what, Ben just was talking about. These, it's going to be, even if it was real, the interpretation is bound to be quote unquote fanciful. And, you have to get used to understand that that's, we're all swimming in this ocean of fancy. You have to, have the humility to recognize that reality. And that we're, we're swimming around together talking about how we could get out of it, right? But it's not something that happens once in a while, right? Everything in personality life is tainted by this quality of fancy. So, but the first step is recognition, and that's why the mind as an intellect have to be developed, even though what you're developing will eventually have to be foregone, for higher mind, which is the true litmus test for everything personality based. Yes, Mikhail. Oh, did you have another one to read?
Yeah, I did. Hold on just one second, Mike. Carol Greenwood says, my salt ocean swim today will clean off tons of my current thought forms and dirty prana, which is why it is so relaxing.
Oh my God, can we meet you there? Which beach are you going from? Gosh, I would love to take that swim with you. Mikhail.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up two things, not to bring up my own experience too much, but when I had my own near-death experience in 2004, I came back and had a really high, like, blissed out state, and I was writing lots of stuff down, and I thought, or I was getting information about X, Y, or Z, and I still have a lot of that writing and it's relevant. But what I found was, first, I couldn't properly contain it in this particular human form. And then I realized that by putting it in a form, it lost its connection to the source. And then I realized the best possible way to convey it was to allow it to permeate my whole being and radiate it. So then when I was in the presence of other people, I was assisting in their process the best way I could without creating this division or this idea. Because I know I've met other people with near-death experience and they just have this whole story and they write the book and then they do the tour and then they just maintain that state. And it makes a lot of sense for other people to plug into that since it's a form. So then people can plug into it. But I didn't feel like it was, felt like that was a glamour. I felt like it was more important to radiate what I made contact with.
Well, the fact that you're able to do that, kudos. That means that you're able to, recontact that field of energy, which I would say is higher mental plane energy. And you're actually able to then immerse yourself in that, by means of the experience you had and become a source of radiation for that energy. And as you said, that's so much more important than telling your probably very cool story. No matter how cool it is, it's a kind of high-end fancy, so yeah, kudos. Thanks for sharing. That's great stuff.
Yeah, so one other thing that you were just talking about, I guess in the earlier part, you talked about how there's the difference between Western psychology and
right.
the esoteric psychology, and I was thinking like they kind of still do work in tandem just when you understand your triggers. Like for me, I had earlier in this life, I was blessed and cursed to have a lot of different like group therapy and psychological work like in my early developmental time. So studying triggers, understanding like, hey, this is because my mom did this or my dad did that or whatever, and differentiating that. But then I came to this really cool thing where you were just talking about Michael's observance, and there was this like, if you look at a waveform, and you look at as if the like the waveform, the top and the bottom as two, and their cause and effect, and your whole purpose to try to cancel out like being in that fancy is to be at that zero point of the cause and the effect. So you understand where it's coming from and you understand what it's going to affect, and it zeroes it out, and then you could be present. So it's like noise cancellation headphones, like you feed back the same sound into the headphones, so then it zeroes out the sound. So it was like a technique that so you have cause and effect at that zero point, so you're like eliminating the trigger.
That's first of all, the whole thing about the psychology, it's very useful in healing cleavages to on your way to individuation under Leo, right? In other words, you're trying to integrate your astral and mental bodies. That's what most people are working on, the physical and etheric bodies were integrated ages ago. Everybody has accomplished that. Most people are working on integrating their mental and astral bodies. And I think, well-presented psychology is fantastic for that work, to actually achieve an integrated personality, which is associated with Leo, right? And from the point of view of occult physics, what that does is it creates a new field, which is the personality ray. And it's only that field that can truly relate to the soul ray. As long as you're caught up in the rays of your lower sheaths, your mental, astral, and physical sheaths, you're if those are the dominant energies in your psyche, you're still in process of integration. But once those three are integrated into a personality ray, then you have the you reach a new threshold. It's even usually a different ray, which then can relate to the soul ray, and you enter a new psychology, which is why DK wrote five books on esoteric psychology, right? I mean, five books on the ray, two on esoteric psychology, but in a way, they're all involved in this process of personality ray interface with the soul ray. So, anyway, okay, well, I'm gonna now say a few comments about this these thought forms that are created by race, nation, and group organization.
Okay, Francis, excuse me for interrupting.
Not gonna happen. No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Your screen, you're not showing your screen, you're just showing your face.
That's no good. What happened?
I think the gremlins are alive and well today.
Yeah, it would seem. Let me think what's going on here. Let me get over here to the Zoom. Oh, when I went out to stop that audio that was playing, it must have knocked me out. So here we are. This should get us back. Yeah, now it's right back, right?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Biel. And okay, so we're going to take a look at number two here. These thought forms are woven from shared dogmas, from shared cultural identities, racial memories, nationalistic beliefs, and even orthodox religious theology, right? Every time an individual aligns with some group ideology, they unconsciously donate a fraction of their own vitality into the collective reservoir of that group. Over time, these forms achieve immense potency, gradually becoming autonomous forces operating in the planetary aura as a significant part of the Great Illusion. These forms are brought about by the magnetic activity of mass participation. When a human being is born into a specific race, nation, and/or religion, their own mental and astral bodies are immediately caught in the gravitational orbit of these massive local structures. And because everyone else is feeding and reacting to the same thought forms, the individual mistakes the sheer weight of consensus for universal truth. Without this incredible, rigorous mental training and self-examination, the mind automatically resonates with these massive collective forms. Especially vulnerable to group illusion are astrally polarized and mass conscious individuals. It is this mass kama manas that forms the root of mob mentality, unexamined national pride, and religious fanaticism, wherein the individual is no longer thinking, but instead is acting as a passive, conductive node through which the collective routes its astral energy. The hint to the earnest aspirant is to recognize one's own participation in these mass illusions and apply divine detachment to extract oneself, to sever the magnetic threads connecting the mental body to these collective thought forms, assiduously eradicating every trace of racial bias, nationalistic identity, and orthodox religious conditioning from their mental aura. This is massive work that is the subject of, you know, a lot of this takes place under Scorpio, right? The tests and trials of Scorpio, keep bringing oneself out of this kama manasic reality. Okay. Next three. That thought form created by a man since his first appearance in physical form and called the dweller on the threshold, being created by the lower personal self and not by the soul. It is impermanent and is simply held together by the man's lower energy. So the ageless wisdom teaches us that the dweller is the personality, right? But it runs much deeper than that. The dweller is actually the sum total of all physical, astral, and lower mental matter utilized and discarded since the monad's very first descent into Lemurian form. Thus, it is composed of unredeemed, crystallized karma and lower vibratory tendencies of literally tens of thousands of incarnations. Every unresolved desire, fear, and selfish ambition generated, you could add a lot to that list, generated over millions of years, has been structurally layered into this single, highly integrated composite elemental, which contains no inherent spiritual intelligence and no connection to the spiritual triad. It is called the dweller on the threshold because it stands at the demarcation line between the higher and lower mental plane. Oh dear. Next. Could we get a reader for this, please?
Yes. Ben, can you read that for us, please?
When the man begins to function as the soul, this image he has created through his fancy or his reaction to delusion is dissipated by a supreme exertion. It has no real existence once there is nothing in the aspirant to feed it. And the realization of this enables him to free himself from this thraldom. This is one of the sutras which, though apparently short and simple, is of the most profound significance. It is studied by high initiates who are learning the nature of the creative process of the planet and who are concerned with the dissipation of planetary maya.
Thank you, Ben. First, when the man begins to function as the soul, this image he has created through his fancy or his reaction to delusion is dissipated by a supreme exertion. It has no real existence once there is nothing in the aspirant to feed it. And the realization of this enables him to free himself from its thraldom. So the destruction of the dweller cannot occur on its own level within the the physical, astral, and lower mental, which is what it's made of. You cannot fight an astral mental construct using astral mental weapons. For a disciple to function as the soul requires that he/she successfully transfer their center of gravity out of the lower personality and anchor it within the causal body. From this vantage point, the disciple is no longer identified with the lower she's and thus can observe the dweller objectively. Because the dweller is the synthetic elemental of the three lower worlds, its structural integrity relies on the disciple continuously supplying it with kama manasic energy and physical vitality. Okay. So, of course, this is progressive, right? I always go back to that statement DK makes about the percentage of atomic matter. You know, at the first initiation, you have 25% atomic matter. And 50% at the second and 75% at the third. This repositioning yourself on the higher mental planes in your own causal body is relative to that functioning, because as long as you are literally composed of lower substance, you will resonate with those substances and therefore to the personality. But even just being able to poke your head out, you know, at the first initiation to get some experience of the higher realities gives you the observer, the foothold, which then increases in its potency and allows you to start doing this work. You know, yes, you're going to have to wait to the third initiation to absolutely transcend the dweller on the threshold, but you don't have to wait to the third initiation to engage in the process. Yes, Tia?
I was going to say, back at HelioSoul, we talked about being the observer. I think we've gone through this and talked in so many different ways about Gabama. We refer to illusion and Maya here and the veils of illusion. So, I mean, there are techniques that you could use probably best in group formation, in problem a world glamour, world glamour. And you can, and Michael has, there are some different recordings on the Makara US website that Michael did dealing with glamour. So that would also introduce you into a way of dealing with this too. So there are all different kinds of ways that you, and resources that are available to help.
Yeah, that's true. And that said, this is one of the best books for that because there's a meticulous step-by-step method for deconstructing both illusion and glamour, which is what this book one of 51 sutras mostly deals with. So looks like we're out of time, folks. I really enjoyed your participation. Thank you for all your thoughts, comments, and questions. It's very stimulating. Yeah, so we have dates.
Yes, coming up next, this Friday, 10 July, is Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Then 2 weeks from today is Secret Doctrine on 19 July. And the next Light of the Soul will be on 2 August. All of these will be at 7 p.m. GMT.
So we're really back on normal schedule now.
Yeah, well, as far as, you know, we go right now.
Yeah, right. Anything can happen, right?
That's right. It all depends on the schedule and the full moons and the other interesting things and ceremonies that are going on. And August and September are a really big time for that. So
yeah. Well, stay abreast. You know, best way is to get the, you know, the mailings. Constant contact mailings that keep you abreast of things. Sylvia Hunt says, Thought Forms, 1905 by Annie Besant and C.W. Leadbeater, an excellent book on the nature of thought forms. Yeah, it is. And it goes way deeper into the form aspect of the thought forms because these two working together were clairvoyant and what they called micro clairvoyant, which allowed them to see even into the construction of an atom. So they were able to actually explore the construction and nature of the thought form. And Ariane says Mercury is retrograde. So that's probably why we had the Tour de France suddenly interrupting our webinar. So, okay, you all, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We'll see you.
Thank you, everyone.
Hope to see you at Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Otherwise, see you next time. Take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, everybody.